many, many months before, and sometimes up to a year before, London Insight, someone contacts me and says, would you be willing to talk on? Yeah. And I just say yes, because I think, well, that's miles away. You know, I'll be able to sort of deepen into that topic. And it's usually about things that one associates with someone who's both a practitioner, a meditator, and a psychotherapist. So they're kind of psychological stroke relational processes. And, you know, today's going to be not too much different from that. But, you know, about a few weeks ago, I thought, oh, I better do a bit of kind of, you know, reading around this, you know, and seeing what it is. And I didn't even know who had suggested it. So I couldn't even go back to them and ask them, what was it you really wanted from me today? And in the deepening into the topic, as mostly happens for me, what I learned was what more and more I didn't understand. I didn't know. That wasn't my truth. That wasn't my reality. And my background's Theravadan Buddhism. So, you know, this is no stranger to me. This territory is not strange to me. My own teacher was from Burma. And, you know, we were drilled in this kind of stuff. But more as if you understood the lists and the teachings, that you would understand, yes, what it meant. And I think hopefully for all of you that are practicing some form of Buddhist practice, you start to understand that these are just invitations for inquiry, and they're nowhere near the truth until they're your own truth, or that through these invitations you find your truth. And that's something that I've always liked about Buddhism, that part of the invitation is, you know, challenge all beliefs, including one's own, you know, and including the teachings of the Buddha, you know, that like anything that's discovered, it becomes a form, it becomes rigid, and therefore it becomes the truth. And I've just got a feeling that that is not what the Buddha's intention was. He really didn't want to create people that all believed in the same things and the same process and the same understanding of reality. And rather, he, you know, my sense if he was in the room was he'd give us a big nudge, and he'd laugh when we were still talking about what he taught 2,500 years ago. You know, he said, well, you know, conditions are different now, and, you know, how I would see it now and how I would explain it now. And I think we've got to keep that in mind, that we have to refresh. My feeling is we need to refresh what the Buddha was inviting us to inquire into. And the way that we will do it as Westerners in these times is going to be different from the way that people at the time of the Buddha, those many hundreds of years ago, practiced and inquired. So with that said, I want to say that I'm certainly not qualified to talk about the absolute terms of these teachings. You know, that's a long way for me to discover. And my sort of small personal experience has been that it's not a straight line, and that the learning comes when it comes, and it comes in pieces quite often. And so in Buddhism, we talk about realization, and that means that you find your own truth. And if it does resonate with, you know, what other people's truths were, that's interesting. But it's more important that it's your truth, that it's what I know, as opposed to what I think and what I've been taught. Welcome. And so to kick us off, I thought I have to do a bit due diligence. And The title of the talk, for those of you who've forgotten, it's Impermanent, Alas, Are Conditioned Things. Impermanent, Alas, Are Conditioned Things. Anicca-vata Sankhara. Anicca-vata Sankhara. So that was the sort of starting point. And as I just told you, you know, don't believe anything, you know. But of course, as my starting point, I thought, well, this is what the Buddha taught, so it must be true. Then I started to think about, what does this mean? What does this mean? And what does he mean by, what is meant by conditioned things? And for most of us, we have to remember that the Buddha's teachings were not actually taped, you know. They were, it was many, many, many years after his passing that things got written down, and the chanting of the teachings in the Theravadan tradition is the way that things were remembered. But those are just the starting points, the starting points. So what I'd like to suggest is, unfortunately, at some levels, conditioned things are not impermanent. They don't seem to end. They don't seem to pass. And at an absolute level, of course, that's true. When one gets to the place where those conditions no longer affect us and they pass, then that's true. But also, we need to, we need to understand that what's conditioning in our times is probably so much more. There's so much more difference, inputs, technology, whatever the word is. You know, I live on Dartmoor, and I love how I'm conditioned. You know, I just really appreciate being conditioned by nature, you know, by the seasons, by the birds that I know come at certain time of the years and then go, by the berries, you know, even by the wildness that sometimes is a challenge to live within, or the big storms or the whatever. But that's what, on a daily basis, that's part of what conditions my experience of the day, of my day. Coming to London, I'm just aware of how much there is going on that impacts, that has an effect, whether we know it or not. But, you know, whether it's a gross effect or a subtle subliminal effect, there's just so much to process if we're not just going to cut off and protect ourselves and contract and constrict. And I see a lot of constriction in me when I come to London. I'm not as available. I'm not as open as I am when I'm working, living and working on Dartmoor. And at the time of the Buddha, you know, there weren't any trains or cars or technology or electricity or. And the density of population was probably very different from how it is now. And how people were in family groups, in community groups, in village groups, was different from how our social systems develop today. So what we are meeting in our conditioning is going to be different. It's not better, it's not worse, but it's different. And so that's why I'm saying, if the teachings were now, if the enlightenment of the awakening was now, it, you know, I sometimes think, how would it look? What would it look like? What would be the encouragement? What would be what the teachings would be like? On an absolute level, I think they would be the same. I imagine they would be the same, but the words would be more encouraging, softer, kinder, you know, understanding that the what an individual needs to be with and to process in their daily lives is just considerable. And we are, I think I mentioned in the little blurb that it's, so we're talking about conditioning. So sankhara, conditioning, volitional activity, predispositions, if you like. It's how we, what we're predisposed to respond, how we are predisposed to respond. So we're talking about responses as well as the impact of our growing up as individuals. And a lot of Western psychology looks at the individual journey, of conditioning. It's quite often an emotional, psychological journey of conditioning. But I just encourage us to expand that possibility that, yes, of course, we're conditioned by our family units, by our birth, by our circumstances, by what we've had to face and respond to in our individual lives over this particular period of time in the world. But if we only focus on that, I think that is unhelpful, because what actually conditions us is much more than the individual journey. You know, it comes in through the individual journey. It comes in through how our carers or our parents were. It comes in through what our, you know, early years were like and so forth. But there's also just this huge wave of ancestral conditioning, of transgenerational conditioning, of universal conditioning, of the collective unconscious mind conditioning, as well as all the things we can actually identify as conditioning, as affecting us, And I'd like that to mean, not that it's going to mean a lot more inquiry and self-responsibility, but to maybe offer the possibility of, my goodness gracious me, we judge ourselves so much in the West when we fail to do what we'd want to. Yes, we're supposed to be happy. Yeah. Gosh, what a goal, you know. And if we're not happy, and we've not successful, whatever that might mean, we have failed, or whatever. Or in Buddhism, you know, in Theravada, they've got the jhanas. You know, I can't say how much I've been in a retreat, especially of Westerners, when they're discussing what jhana have you reached, you know, and you know. Do you think that refers to the fourth or the fifth jhana? You know, and so again, it's an achievement based. You know, people can get on this wheel and find themselves being conditioned in the Buddhist practice to practice it in a way that's conditioned by factors that we're not quite sure about. We didn't notice that this is what's influencing the way we practice, or the way we are in our lives, or the way we are in relationships and community. So what I'd like you to feel is, well done for each tiny glimpse of freedom from the constrictions of mind, body, relational activity, you know, just that glimpse of how you didn't take that personally, just once, you know, in one's relationships, or when the Uber was late, you know, or when they run out of sandwiches on the train, or, you know, it's if you even glimpses of not taking things personally, and that includes the things that we don't feel we've succeeded with. You know, it's like, don't take that personally, because there's just such a drenching of conditioning that we need to both, I feel, be curious about, but also to realize that this one little individual dealing with everything that has conditioned me, conscious and unconscious, and taking responsibility for it, like it's up to me, yeah, to be happy, to be in touch with the Brahma Vihara, to be heartful, to be whatever your goal is. I don't actually know what my goal is. I think just kind of, I'd settle for okay, you know. And if I got that 3 days out of seven, I'd be very happy indeed, you know. And just kind of comfortable to live in my own skin and not judging myself by either internal or external expectations. And of course, Buddhism has got expectations down. You know, expectations lead to disappointment. Probably everyone's heard that before. Yes, yes, it's true, that's true. And yet there's something in me that still has these expectations of myself. And that when I don't, when I fail, and often I don't know even what I was supposed to succeed in. You know, it's just like, it's almost like a script that's, that everything leads to didn't do well enough, you know. And if we can challenge that and understand that human beings, we're doing the best we can in the midst of everything, in the midst of everything that shapes us, and in the midst of waking up in the morning, how that is, you know, brushing our teeth, going to the toilet, having a cup of tea, whatever that is, that somehow, even when we're sort of in our low and down and difficult territories inside ourselves, we're doing the best we can. Success is not measured by the lack of adversity, the lack of dukkha. You know, that's not a measurement of how well we're doing, because mostly all of us, at least at some points in time in our life, have to face life's experiences. And, you know, they make us feel unhappy. They make us feel sad and full of sorrow or angry or whatever it is. But in the midst of that, we might still be doing well, you know. So the expectation that one should meet everything well, you know, is, oh, what a burden, what a burden. And maybe well is today I'm not even going to try. You know, maybe that's well, maybe that's skillful, that's sensible. So within, let's see, make sure that I don't want to do big chunks of talking. So I would like to, so okay, the things that condition are personal, but they're ancestral, they're universal, they're transgenerational, and the teachings say when conditions cease, the effects of those conditions cease. That's part of the teachings. So that's true sometimes. That is definitely true sometimes. So when my headache goes, conditions, which was also conditioned before that, but and it goes back and back and back. When my headache stop, the effects stop. Yep. I don't feel the pain. Done. If life was just that easy. But some of the conditions live in us all our lifetimes through. And our responses live in us all our lifetimes through, from when we were conceived. You know, some of you know me well. I think time and womb time is extremely important time for shaping our responses, to conditions. But throughout our childhood, for sure, throughout our lives, how we respond to our experiences and the experiences themselves are quite often completely remembered in some way within the body, within our relational experiences, and within our the mind, in terms of the conceptual mind, the imaginal mind, our thoughts, yes, and some of the, so within our bodies, within our relational lives, within our perceptual lives, yes, within our, the ways that we think about ourselves and think about others and respond and react. So that what happened to us, something not too personal. I can't actually stretch through them and make them not too personal. So I'll just generalize. What happened to us when mum got sick, when we were little and went into hospital? What happened to us when one of the parents shouted at us or continued to shout at us, when they got annoyed with us, yeah, because they were angry a lot? What happened to us when we were embarrassed going into school because we didn't know something? What happened to us when we got bullied? What happened to us when we bullied? What happened to us when we shouted at our children? What happened? So all of these experiences leave imprints. And I'm going to talk about body briefly, that within, because in the sort of blurb for the talk, I talked about body, speech, and mind. Those are kind of Buddhist-like numbers, and these threes are quite significant. So there's a model in Buddhism that talks about the three kayas, and it comes from Tibetan Buddhism. And it's basically, it talks about 5, 7, and 10 kayas, but we're just going to stick to three. And if you just narrow it down, it talks about body as the first kaya, speech, meaning relational activity, emotions, energies, is the second kaya, middle kaya, sambhoga kaya. And then the third kaya is, in its absolute, is, you know, emptiness, enlightened mind, awakened mind, where no conditioning exists. Wouldn't that be pleasant? But within the other two kayas, so within the kaya of body, of rupa, I won't go into that, but it actually contains thoughts as well. Rupa, whatever is a form is rupa, but rupa for this purpose is body. Whatever is laid down as a body experience can be remembered forever, not necessarily through image or concept or remembering in its usual way, but because it shaped our responses. It's in the cells of our body. And for those of you familiar with Buddhism, this is linked to an understanding of the nature of citta, that which knows. Sometimes citta is described as mind, and that's also true, or citta is usually understood as conditioned mind, conditioned knowing. But actually, within even conditioned knowing, there is something that is not conditioned, that knows how things are, what this is about. Yeah, it kind of cuts through ignorance, which is one of the things I'm going to talk about a wee while, I think. So that which knows lays down a cellular memory. You don't have to believe this, be open to this. Possibly lays down a cellular memory, because in every cell of our body, there is that which knows, from the point of conception through to the point that we die, and who knows beyond, I don't know. And this knowing gets conditioned, gets obscured, gets hidden. But within even the most conditioned response, the origins of that response, the context of that response is remembered. And it's remembered in the very cells of our body through the quality of mind that's called citta, that mind that knows. And it also knows good things. So I just wanted, I'm usually the bringer of doom and gloom. And I was just sort of thinking about memories of good things, of good moments, of good experience, of good relational contact, of good internal sense of well-being, of love. And it's, you know, love in particular is kind of the fulcrum of when experiences get laid down in the body that lean towards good, or kusla, skillful, good experiences. And when love is denied, when love is constricted, when love is not present relationally in the early days and ongoing, then usually what gets laid down and remembered is difficulty, pain, and all sorts of depths of that. So when it says, when the causes stop, so do the effects, that's true, you know, when the dentist stops drilling my tooth. Or is it? Because the next time I go back, if it wasn't a good experience, the condition continues into the next time I go back to the dentist. What I'm suggesting is that actually conditions are laid down within our bodies, energetically, physically, through this sort of subtle and subliminal experience of embodiment, that lay traces and threads of, it's almost as if the predispositions are just ready to respond again in the same way as they responded a million times before to the experience of the perceived similar situation. Yeah. So psychoanalytically, they call that lots of things. Projection is one of them, but it's much more than a cognitive experience. It's a bodily response to situations. And all the lovely work that's been, lovely work that's been done within trauma over the last couple of decades, and working with individuals' experiences of understanding trauma, understanding what happens to the nervous system that gets preset if not just big traumas happen, but ongoing traumas happen. We get preset to be, to respond to even small traumatic experiences or shocking experiences with just this big response of all the trauma that we've ever experienced before. Still following me a little bit? Don't have to agree, but if you follow me, that's good. So I'm going to come back to body, of course, because it's all here, isn't it? My whole story's right here. And how I've responded to my stories right here. And within Buddhist practice, the invitation is, we can't change the conditions, or the causes, I should say, but we can change our responses in the present. So drop that just to one side for a minute. So if we come into the middle of the kayas, of the territories, which is usually called speech, or it relates to Sambhogakaya within the Tibetan tradition. And speech is it's true how we it's about communication, but it's not just about speech. It's about what we communicate in relationship to other people, and what you feel other people are communicating to you. There's an awful exercise that I probably won't ask you to do, but it's basically just sort of being with another person, or looking at, if I look at you all in the room, which I can't do all at once, but sort of, but if I sort of stick with one, probably one that person I don't know well, my body will tell me what the person thinks and feels about me. It's not always right. In fact, it's usually, hopefully, not always right, because quite often I get, I'm not doing very well here. You know, that's my conditioning. So there's that sort of bodily experience of being with another, which is called speech in this model. And it's to do with relational experiences, all levels, you know. Again, it's about how we are in relationship now, quite often, is very similar to whether or not we were experiencing safety and love in our early years, more or less, not all the time, good enough, or whether it wasn't like that. It sort of it flowed to the other side of good enough. And for the people that have had good enough early experiences, I just think, marvelous, wonderful. I stayed yesterday with one of my daughters and her almost 3-year-old daughter, so my granddaughter. And I just watched my daughter and her partner parenting, and I just sort of thought, oh God, I did it so badly. You know, what if I only knew now, you know, then what I know now, you know, I was, and just a real appreciation of their parenting, which I think happens when I'm not there too, because the child looks like she experiences consistent parenting. And she's just not made wrong or bad for anything, you know. And I don't know about you all, but I was brought up, I'm looking around, some of you in my generation, I was brought up in a time that the child was always wrong. you know, just always wrong. You know, the supper tea, I'm from Scotland, tea was not, you know, what dad wanted, you know, shout at mum or whatever. But it was, I had to pick her up from school or something or another, or, well, I had, you know, she distracted me, or he just, it's like the child just kind of always somehow got the blame or wasn't good enough, it was difficult, you know, having all these children, you know, and to the hope that there's a generation, that's bringing their children up differently means for me something much bigger than just my daughter and her partner bringing my granddaughter up like this. Gives me hope, because it changes people. And, you know, I look around the room and I would imagine that a lot of us have not had very good childhoods, have had things that we've had to confront, or maybe even more than not good enough, you know, circumstances, whatever that might have been. And for those of us who have been damaged, deeply affected in a detrimental way, so the effects are detrimental, and how we've responded to that have been hard and difficult, you know, I just have huge amazement of how people continue to move towards wellness and what makes what makes you a person in your life that you're happy to be with, yeah, sitting in your own skin, and that you're happy to be with those people. In psychotherapy, quite often we meet folk who have had really difficult histories, going back generations quite often. And it's always, I feel humbled by how well they continue to try to change, to make it right, to find a way in this lifetime, not to give up, and not to believe the deeper conditioning, you know, that something that's still there that moves towards well-being, joy, and love. So I would imagine we've got the spectrum in the room. I've only met one person who had such an ongoing positive childhood that he could not relate to difficulty and pain. He trained with us, and we decided actually it was probably best to part ways at some point in time, because being with Dukkha, I think that's changed in his lifetime, because I'm still in touch with him, but being with Dukkha wasn't his forte. He didn't know what it was, you know. I mean, of course he did at a deep level, but that his relational experiences didn't contain those challenges. And so that's an aside. Yeah, if there's anybody in the room that's like that, wonderful. Yeah. Come and have some tea with me. I just want it to rub off a bit on me, you know. Just sit there, you know. So the memories, the traces, the imprints of past experiences, past causes, and then our responses, or the effects, as it would be worded within the teachings, but our responses, bodily and relationally, remain as memories, so they've not gone. You know, although the situation has changed, and maybe we're in a really happy relationship, meditation, sangha, things are good, those memories are still there. And they're almost like, they almost sabotage us. You know, it's such a pull, such a strength of conditioned responses. It's so hard. They don't change through simply understanding them. They don't change through cognition alone. It's a way in, and that's great. But they will only change through our working through our body awareness and through relational mindfulness. That's my belief. That they don't have the opportunity to change. They're usually laid down in relationship, and laid down in very early dependent relationships. And you know, the mother and father carry the, you know, it's in Christianity, up until the seventh generation, we carry the sins of the fathers. Is that, is anybody a Christian in the room? Oh my goodness. thank you. thank you. I think it's said in the Bible, though not firsthand read, that the sins of the fathers are manifested up until the seventh generation. And for me, that just is, it's, I don't have to believe that there are sins, but maybe the experience of the fathers manifest through at least seven generations until they are perhaps worked through. And there was an expression for some time in our training that we use, which was called, we don't use it a lot now, it's backward healing. And it's as if we manage to free ourselves of some of our old ways of responding, then it breaks the link generationally. I don't know if you follow that. So we're healing our ancestors as well as, although they're quite often dead. But an example of that that might be easier. When I first moved to America, I was quite young. And my relationship with my mother was complex. And so I was doing some personal work on that, and it was in therapy. And it was working way back into sort of conception and gestation and all sorts of things. That was the territory. And I, you know, some things sort of cleared, got clearer. Some things were not so much in delusion, you know, in ignorance. Some things revealed, some truths showed up. And through support, I was able to meet some of those truths. And so delusion or ignorance around them started to clear. It took much longer before they cleared emotionally or through my relationals or whatever. But I remember getting a phone call from my mother around the same time. And she sounded like she liked me. And, you know, and it sounded different. And she was concerned about how was I doing, you know, and how was my life. And it was just like, I never heard my mother to be like that. And there's part of me feels as if I hadn't done the work that I'd done around that, you know, for me, these connections are mysterious, but it does feel we're all deeply connected, especially, of course, through our ancestry. But even in this room, if someone's with something that opens up into clear seeing or knowing in someone in the room, my belief and the experiential belief is that benefits us all. You know, there's something about breaking the chain somewhere. It's not just a personal accomplishment. So body is cellular, speech relational, and it's also our moods, our temperaments, and of course the body and the relational experiences, that quality of predispositions, yes, they imbue one another. My body is preset to respond to situations that at some level I perceive as the same as the ones 10,000 years ago, unconsciously, and it happens. But then it gets imbued with the relational quality of that, which is the qualities of intimacy, of connection, of, deep seeing, deep hearing, deep knowing. And so then a kind of quality and emotional predisposition mood arises within that, a kind of a field out of which other responses come. And we go to mind, if we don't take it as the unconditioned mind for a minute, there's also the conditioned mind, which most of us have to deal with most of the time, how we think, what our judgments are, what our perceptions are, how we manage information, what our predisposition is to think of something in a particular way, to touch something in a particular way, to respond to somebody in a particular way. Now, that's not the unconditional mind. Most of us just really know an awful lot about the conditioned mind. Do you agree? You know, that's what the first stages of mindfulness training is about. It's getting a hang of that, you know, so as it's just not driving us. It slows it down. And it gives us an opportunity to not not challenge that truth, but to start to begin to think, and of course, most of that is just random, arbitrary thinking with no real cause and effect associated to it. Yeah, it's just situational. It seems to be situational. So I'm talking about this sort of conditioned mind as opposed to the unconditioned mind. And I think it was the Buddha that said that if you try to unravel cause and effect, you'll go mad. I like that. Because he's suggesting, apart from obvious things like somebody punches you in the mouth and your lip bleeds, if you try and think, well, you know, how I am right now, and you try and link it to one cause, it will drive you mad because it's so complex and it's so random quite often that actually what you think of as reality, because this is how you are because of, very seldom true. You know, this is how I am because I'm a tangle of my conditions. And if I try and sort out the conditions and the causes, I'll go mad. So where am I in this? What choices do I have? So although I'm suggesting there are causes that get registered in the body, the relational experiences, and the mind that endure, they are complex. And the longer we live, the more complex they become, because the further away from actual cause, if there was an actual cause. And even the actual cause, we could have responded to without fully knowing the truth of that. So complex. And so what can I do? What can I do? And I guess this is very personal to all of us, but that's the challenge. You know, if you're never going to get to the bottom of it, if that's not the way to feel happy, what can you do? Well, you're all insight meditators, so I guess one of the things you can do is don't believe yourself. You know, don't believe that what you think, especially relationally, is true. Be open to the possibility you got it wrong. Maybe there's some other pieces of experience information that might attune you a bit better in the situation. But I think the biggest challenge is how we relate to ourselves. I'm really almost okay with pausing my reactions in relationships, not always, almost. It's so much harder to pause my reactions to myself, you know. And over the years, my experience has been that most of the people that I have met or worked with or taught, deep, deep, deep down, do not believe they are okay. That they are fundamentally good. That so often there's a saboteur in there. There's a lack of self-confidence. There's shame. I think Achin Suchita was teaching this. And I don't know if it was London Insight or not. But he was just talking about that inside one that is so deeply hidden and conditioned, because it is shameful and it's vengeful and it's all the things that one doesn't want to be, that steals our happiness. It steals, it does not allow us to believe that this one deserves dot 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 dot. Yes, it deserves in all sorts of levels, deserves to be liked, deserves to be loved, deserves gosh, the list goes on and on and on. But when it comes to my meditation practice, that's where it hurts for me the most, because there's something in there. And maybe what my invitation to you is, maybe we can check this out, you can check it out. But is there something in you that does not believe that you can experience bliss, joy, and awakening? You know, I'm in my 70s. I've been practicing since I was 20. It's 50 years. Most of it's based on trying. Yeah. If I just try this practice, or if I just come to this, I'll try this in a different way. Or maybe if my energy was more like this, or I don't know how many hours of retreat and meditation I've done. You know, I was a nun for a while as well. And for me, an investigation of this trying to succeed is based on something within me which does not believe that I deserve. Dot, dot, dot. But within my spiritual life, that is so painful. That sort of sense that I don't deserve to be happy, to feel joy, to feel love, to know the unconditioned. And of course, that inside me is not thinking she doesn't deserve to know the unconditioned. You know, it's just, it's a blanket you don't deserve, you know. And Achin Suchita, I think, was suggesting we all have our own versions of that. And no matter how hard and long we practice and how well our life might be going, it's still there. It sort of pulls the rug out when we least expect it. And it constricts us. It makes us less than, holds us into being less than what is possible, what could be. So I wanted to, and it's been a bit long, so I'm sorry. I just wanted to lay down how deeply rooted our conditional experiences are, our conditional beliefs, experiential beliefs, condition our responses. And our conditional beliefs were conditional not just in this lifetime, but the conditional beliefs that perhaps we've inherited from our parents, from our culture, from our religion, from our social background, So it's like these are deeply held ancestral, can just be personal, but ancestral, transgenerational, cultural, societal beliefs. And in Western society, it does not help because there's that expectation that we've got to succeed. And succeed usually means self-sufficient, be able to have a job, succeed, have enough money to have somewhere to live. And then people that look like they've got more than that, they've succeeded more, haven't they? Or have they, you know? And so we're conditioned to think that this is what success looks like. And one of the big challenges of what COVID, I think, has offered us is to challenge, is this what success looks like? You know, is this what this, you know, wait a minute. Because for a lot of us, that has been challenged. And that, whatever we were before lockdown or whatever, there have been implications of lockdown which have challenged what we think success looks like. So if we started to reframe what success looks like together, I don't mean now, you know, we don't have to create a master plan on Sunday in London at St. Luke's, but if you started to reconsider and give yourself agency in terms of, what, for me, what would a good life look like? What would to live in a good life look like? What do I value? What could I challenge? So there's ways to challenge this deep social, cultural, political conditioning, religious conditioning. And as the Buddha really said, is, you know, wake up. You know, wake up, learn from the conditions, and the conditions of COVID for many of us have had times when it's been really hard. And we've, maybe some people in the room have lost people to COVID or know of somebody. But that's not all that's going on in the world. Climate crisis for me is the big one, obviously. But then, you know, if I open up to, you know, Afghanistan, to Syria, to, you know, it just to America, you know, it goes on and on and on. And there's so little I can do in the face of that. But maybe I can do something. And maybe that is to challenge what is of meaning, what is of value. And the Buddha just said, wake up, don't believe other things, challenge all beliefs. And if that's really true, he's inviting us to, well, what's important for us, what gives meaning to me. I'm not there yet, but I know it's shifted a lot in the last decade. Age helps because, you know, I'm not going to, I don't know, do lots of things, fly an aeroplane or swim the channel, I don't think, you know. Or have children, you know, or whatever it, you know, might be. You know, there's lots of things I can't be, but what do I want?